Hello, this is Jonathan Marks via PCJ Online, just about to push the button on another programme from the media network Vintage Radio Archives.
By shortwave, medium wave, satellite, and the World Wide Web, this is the Dutch International Service, Radio Netherlands. Multimedia Network. A survey of new and traditional technology connecting across borders. This edition is produced and presented by Diana Janssen and Jonathan Marks.
Hello, welcome to half an hour of news from the world of wireless. Glad you found us, and we hope you're enjoying reasonable reception after time and frequency changes this past weekend.
If there are reception problems, please drop us a line or send us an email, and you can help us by being specific as possible about any interference.
This is the service of Radio St. Helena, operating in the medium wave band on a frequency of 1548 kilohertz, 194 meters.
Yes, a life on the ocean wave. A bit of a follow-up to last week now, and it was nice to be able to tune into Radio St. Helena last Sunday evening while going through some papers. They had a very successful few hours on shortwave as part of a special St. Helena Day celebration. So successful, judging by the emails, that they'll have another one on October 26, 1997, according to their webpage. Thanks to David Ward in Norwich in the UK, who phoned the station to send greetings to Radio Netherlands. Interesting way around. In fact, there were quite a lot of well-known names that popped up on the wireless. Good reception here in Europe and in the eastern part of North America, it seems. The 1500-watt SSB transmitter was also well heard in India.
John Campbell was one of the people calling in, and he also sent us an email because a parrot in North America decided to pop up on the Radio St. Helena frequency a few hours before the real event. Radio Eurogeek had news, sports and weather at 1749 UTC on 11902.5 USB, according to several logins on the internet, including the news that Jonathan Marks of Radio Netherlands had been kidnapped.
Really? Well, I'm glad to say that Ian McFarland has paid the ransom of 10 international reply coupons, and I've been reunited with family and friends. No doubt FBI officials are looking for the pirate radio owner.
Right. Tom Sandstrom has been helping us keep our list of radio-related internet sites up to date on the Radio Netherlands worldwide website. The hot list is in our section called Real Radio. And checking before we came into the studio, I note that Radio Free Asia's website has come up at last. The URL is www.rfa.org. With one exception, most of the US private radio stations have old schedules on their websites.
But it's a different story on the other side of the Atlantic, where European sites have been updated. One of the most comprehensive is that of the Voice of Russia. That's on www.vor.ru. Some radio sites give more than frequencies. How about this? Asian match for Belgian man, 40 years of age, 6 foot tall, aromatherapist. Girl should be 28 to 35 years, slim, tall, charming, and intellectual, of course. Willing to settle in France. Reply as soon as he's visiting India shortly. Yes, pages and pages of matrimonials. One way a new website is generating income.
Yes, Lou Joseph's passed on the tip to check a new radio station on the web that's active in India. So we did check www.radioasianet.com. It's an audio-on-demand service focusing on Asian people living anywhere in the world. They provide subcontinental news, stock and shares, and information on things like tourism, real estate, and, as you just heard, matrimonials. Audio is available on demand in Hindi and English in 40.4 and 28.8 kilobits per second.
Internet here in the Netherlands has been getting a bit of a bashing. Manufacturers have been analysing why a multimedia fair in Amsterdam failed to attract less than half the numbers expected. Organised in mid-October, computer and hi-fi manufacturers thought they'd get 200,000 people to visit what they called Emotion 96 in the southern part of Amsterdam. They got 85,000 at best. The organisers are now putting the blame on the advertising agency, who decided to use Spock, the character in Star Trek, as the main person to promote the event. Spock, of course, having no emotion. But the average person here thought it was more of a science fiction fair, and more than half the population didn't realise this multimedia fair was really going on. Millions of guilders, pounds, sterling have been lost. Some smaller companies are on the verge of bankruptcy, and it's unlikely that the event will take place again in 2 years as originally planned.
And there's also publicity surrounding an internet survey published in the Algemeen Dagblad newspaper. A company called Ilse did this survey and concluded that half of the accesses to the internet in the Netherlands are from people surfing at work. Most of the time, their queries have nothing to do with work-related questions. Analysis of the Netherlands Internet Index shows that Philips is the largest user of internet amongst companies. But an analysis on October 24th revealed most of the searches from offices at Philips were in the erotic or holiday sphere, not much related to electronics or light bulbs.
If you like the show, write to us. If you don't like the show, my address will follow at the end of the program. This is your announcer speaking.
Well, now let's bring up the line to Arthur Cushion in the Pacific for his report. Arthur, in 1997, Radio Netherlands celebrates 50 years on the wireless. It'll be 70 years of international broadcasting from Holland, if you count the commercial activities of Philips with PCJJ, amongst others. In New Zealand, you're just about to celebrate another radio anniversary, a 75th.
That's right. November the 17th is the mark of the 75th anniversary. It was on that date in 1921 that Professor Jack at the Physics Laboratory at Otago University in Dunedin first broadcast music. He had been experimenting since August of that year, but finally got started. And by 1922, there were 6 experimental stations, but the government of those days was hesitant and just stood off and did nothing.
That sounds familiar. In fact, I believe the New Zealand government only really found out about the power of broadcasting in 1935, when the Labour Party had a party political broadcast that was so successful it led to nationalisation of radio soon afterwards. Now governments are in the process of trying to sell things off again.
That's the sort of history, but it's interesting to know that in 1922 the licence fee was 3 shillings, and they had estimated 200 listeners then. And it's really the pioneers, the amateurs and those who pioneered broadcasting in New Zealand that got us really started.
Arthur, you've just had elections in New Zealand, and just a few weeks ago there were reports of staff reductions at Radio New Zealand, even a funding problem for the overseas service Radio New Zealand International.
There has been a recent press comment that the government should take a look at the funding of our national radio and Radio New Zealand International, and at the present, when there's discussions on the future government with the unsettled political position, that no drastic changes should be made. There's staff reductions on the national radio have been mooted, but it's felt that shouldn't take place until things are definitely in more concrete as far as the government of the country is concerned.
And looking at the internet, it would seem that Radio New Zealand International has made a frequency change.
They have. They've gone back to 9700 kilohertz, which you use during our winter. They've moved from 6100, 0815 through to 1200. Radio Free Asia, they've been heard on a new channel. That's 13800 kilohertz, and that's opening at 2300 to China. That's from the Saipan transmitter. The other frequency from Saipan remains. That's 9455 kilohertz.
OK, let's go back to the fact that as from October 27th, Radio Netherlands has been hiring some airtime from the Centex shortwave transmitter station at Meyerton near Johannesburg. The signal is beamed at West Africa, but it's being heard in New Zealand quite well too, I understand.
That's right, Jonathan. That's a very good signal on 11655, 1730, 2025. We can hear the signal up to 2000 and it's very good at 1830. There is a positive identification with the transmitter site given, which I feel that would be great for radio listeners. It proves that the transmission and the frequency is to what they're tuned. In Thailand, the BBC new relay is now in operation. 2 frequencies in use, 6065 at 0900 with 15 minutes of news and business. Then English spoken programs. Chinese at 1000, then English again at 1100. The other channel is 9580, but in this area it's blocked by Radio Australia. So that's another new outlet from the BBC. I also note that 15070, which actually had the call GWC when I look at my 1940 records, they've dropped that channel and now on 15575 we're hearing them at good strength about 0900.
Indeed, it's goodbye to 15070, a famous out-of-band channel. Things are pretty active down on the 49-metre band, what with autumn in this part of the world. Of course, spring down your way.
Most of the Latin American countries can be heard. If we look at some of the countries, 6065 for Argentina, Bolivia, Santa Cruz, 6135, 0900. It's a surprisingly good signal. There's plenty of Brazilians, 5980, 6000, 6040 would be the best. Chile, 6090, and Mexico, 6010 Radio Mill, and 6185, that's the educational radio. In Peru, we hear Radio Union, 6115. Here in the Philippines and the Pacific, FEBC, Manila, English is 0930 to 1100 on 11635. PBS, that's the Filipinas Broadcasting System, 0230, 0300 in English, it's 15120 and 15270. That's the better channel. They have news around 0305 UTC.
Arthur, thanks for those tips. Now back to Europe. Diana.
Certain sectors of the BBC will be celebrating this coming weekend. On the 2nd of November 1936, the BBC started the world's first regular high-definition television service from Alexandra Palace in the northern part of London. The BBC's staff magazine, Ariel, has an amateur radio group and they plan to celebrate the event by holding a party on the Hambans, and they're inviting anyone involved in any aspect of broadcasting to take part, from facilities to microphone work. The BBC will be celebrating by using a special call sign, GB60BBC, possibly from Alexandra Palace.
Now, if you have a ham radio licence and your own transmitter, then mention your broadcasting connection if you succeed in contacting them. Shortwave listeners are also being invited to submit reception reports showing date, time, details of the station being worked by GB60BBC and which broadcast affiliation was mentioned by the other side. A certificate will be awarded to anyone sending in a correct entry to this address. Brian Bauer, 19 Chapel Road, Flackwell Heath, High Wycombe in Buckinghamshire, and the postal code is HP109AB. That's Brian Bauer, 19 Chapel Road, Flackwell Heath, High Wycombe, Buckinghamshire, HP109AB. And you must send your reception report to arrive by the 1st of January at the latest. This on-air QSO party, as it's being called, will start at 1 minute past midnight on Saturday the 2nd of November and last for 24 hours. You might want to check the following frequencies for activity. 3720, 7060, 14180, 18160, 21380, 24960, and 28380 kilohertz. That's for communications in single sideband. If you can understand Morse code, check these channels: 3530, 7030, 10135, 14055, 18075, 21075, 24905, and last but not least, 28075 kilohertz.
You can also get the latest frequencies by checking the Aerial Radio Group's website at www.xdinet.demon.co.uk/arg.
Media Network. It's a tough job, but somebody's got to do it.
John Campbell, professor at University College London in Britain, is with us again. and this time in his capacity as a computer specialist. We've just been changing all the computer systems at Radio Netherlands, partly to make sure that we can expand our new media services in the course of next year. John Campbell, though, is busy with the sort of computer systems we'll be using in the year 2010.
That's about the right year, I think, yes. We hope that we're not confined to one flat screen and one keyboard. That's something you can learn to use in an office, but there are lots of other media that would be quite comfortable along with it. In fact, you might even like to try some singing to go along with your latest office memorandum. So I think the magic word is multimedia, and you're persuading me that I should be talking about multimedia. If you do use such facilities, and they do work on aspects of that, you will certainly get a system which is quite different from the one that you see on your hobby room table or your office table at the moment.
In what way will it be different?
You'll be able to mix and use different types of medium inside individual messages. You can do that in a small way now, but it will become much more natural. For example, if it turns out that you want to attach to some text or some set of pictures an appropriate piece of music, or somebody reading a memorandum which is buried at the bottom of your files, because it's better to hear a voice reading this sort of thing than to read it, it should be fairly easy to do that without much pain. You can do all of that now, but you've got to have three arms and be an expert editor. What's necessary, I think, for minimum communication for users who are not specialists is to be able to do that kind of thing without having to use three arms and without having to use two brains to figure out what to do next.
So how do you think it will change the way people perform in their jobs?
The best quick answer to that, I think, is to say that we are supposed to behave efficiently when we are doing things with a bunch of other humans. There are things we can do together in collaboration which go quite smoothly, as long as we don't fight them. The sort of jobs we do in offices are approximations to that when the humans are represented by that computer terminal. You are communicating with people, but indirectly, very indirectly. Suppose you're talking about making decisions in some joint decision-making exercise. Right now, if you can't meet them all in one place, you've got to send messages and do all sorts of unsatisfactory things. What you would like is something like a video conference facility. You want it to feel absolutely indistinguishable from the way a meeting feels, when everyone's together in a room. And making that sort of feeling come through screens or other presentations is a great deal more difficult than it looks. But if we can do that, it'll be quite a different environment from what we have at the moment.
I once heard somebody say that he would quite happily pay twice the amount it would cost for video conferencing if he could see the other party 20 seconds after the meeting had finished and actually could see what their reactions were. One of the points being that in many cultures, a face-to-face communication is the only way to do business.
I think we probably have some company already thinking about that idea, making multimedia bugs for 2010. But even in the meeting, there are occasions when it's useful to look sideways at somebody and see how he took that last interjection. At the moment, you can't do that, certainly with the video conferencing systems of the present day. But there are ways to get that kind of facility. I think the best way to give an audience a picture of what's going on is to ask you to think about television and think about occasional presentations of, for example, complicated sports, Olympic Games, football, or things like that. Sometimes, when they show you how these things are made, or when they've got some spare time at the beginning of the program, they give you a picture of how things are put together. You see a very hot booth with engineers in shirt sleeves, puffing and panting. In front of them, a bank of monitors showing different views of what's going on. And, of course, you only see one such view at a time, but there is someone rather like an orchestral conductor who is effectively getting a selection from those views and showing them to you on your screen. But you might say, well, I'm getting one of those views, but I would like to see a view of, for example, my team's supporters' band playing music when people are throwing flower bombs at them. Can't I have that, please? At the moment, you can't have it, because the editor says no. But it's there, the television feed is there, and it would be useful to be able to interact with what's available at present in broadcasting organizations to see things like that and compose your own view of the activity, rather than taking one view from your single television screen.
Don't you think bandwidth would be a problem?
Right now, that is the main problem. If I wanted to do this tomorrow, my main problem is that the connecting medium between the studio or the transmitter and you hasn't really advanced very much in the last 100 years or so. But if you look at the descriptions of future of communications in special feature articles in newspapers and similar places, you will see magic phrases or abbreviations like ISDN, which from our point of view is simply an abbreviation for a much higher bandwidth system. Now, the only reason why you don't have that sort of thing today or tomorrow is the simple expense of rewiring the world or the parts of it that you're in at this higher standard. But that's only a temporary delay. It's basically economic, not an engineering delay. And if there is economic advantage in providing this sort of thing, it will get provided. Don't worry about that. So the only reason why we have this limitation is that we are living in this year. Give us another 10 years, 10 to 15 years, and you'll find that the ordinary processes of commerce bend that bandwidth limitation, or at least push it into corners where it doesn't worry you so much.
Thank you for calling the Windows 95 installation helpline. Please choose your selection by pressing the associated number on your touchtone phone. If you do not have a touchtone phone, you are obviously living in the dark ages and don't even deserve to be using Windows 95. For the rest of you, choose one of the following.
If you need help on installing Windows 95, press 1. For help on setting up your computer hardware, press 2. If you think you're better than everyone else, press 3. If you're having trouble getting your old Windows programs to work with Windows 95, press 4. If Bill Gates started his own religion and you would follow him anywhere and give him all your money, press 7. To hear these choices again, please press 0.
But as far as the internet is concerned, isn't there a danger that it's slowing down, perhaps even coming to a grinding halt?
The internet is a special case. It was not designed as an architecture anything like the architectural design that you see now. It just grew. There's a famous English phrase, a story, which contains a punchline, "I just growed." That's the story of the internet. Now, people who are using it in places like England, where there are plenty of customers, are already complaining about delays through their service providers. The poor old service providers probably are not at fault. They're doing the best they can. But again, the bandwidth problem exists. If the internet gets very successful, it attracts lots of users and lots of traffic, it will eventually fall over under its own weight. If it doesn't fall over, it just means that it's not getting successful fast enough. It will eventually fall over. The kind of picture that fits that best, I think, is a picture that I've seen once or twice in Australia. When people first started to run large farms inland in Australia, they were pretty close to the soil, pretty basic, and their houses are pretty basic. A shack consisting of bits of metal and wattle, mud, gum trees and so on. And as they got more successful in the farming business, so in some cases, bigger and fancier add-ons were built on the sides of the basic homestead. And as things got even more fancy, that's to say the British export market and freezing in ships opened up, add-ons were made to the add-ons. And on one particular spectacular occasion, the whole thing eventually caved in. The center collapsed and the rest of it collapsed over the center because the original structure simply could not handle what was added to it.
But if the internet collapses, what will replace it?
I think something with the successful features of the present internet architecture, almost anybody who uses the internet can describe accurately what sort of thing is there. If I ask you to draw block diagrams and make a picture of what the internet was to somebody who didn't know about it, that would be a pretty fair picture of the architecture that you want to support communications in the future. The problem is that the wiring or the plumbing, etc., that supports that, which is the analog of the tin shed I was talking about, simply cannot support much more. A giant rebuild is called for, I think. But in the case of the internet architecture, it doesn't require abolishing all your internet connections and waiting till somebody starts again. The building can be held up by scaffolding in some parts, while small armies of gnomes frantically rebuild the other parts. I think you'll find that there's a painful process going on in there for the people who are rebuilding, but there is a good chance it will not feel too painful to the poor old user out there. At the worst, what you might find for a while is more bottlenecks, more irritation, and so on. But in the long run, the architecture will change underneath you to give you better service.
Do you expect people to change the pricing structure? At the moment, the advantage of the internet is that you can call up information, let's say, on a server in Hawaii or Groningen or wherever it is. It doesn't matter where the information comes from. You pay a flat fee, which you don't do if you're using the telephone. Does that mean to say that you'll see a different structuring?
I don't think the structure will change very much because the structure that you see at the moment is accurate at a commercial or engineering level, certainly accurate at a commercial level, and it doesn't distort the underlying engineering. It shouldn't cost more to get you a message from somewhere in the farming territory here in this country than it would cost you to get a message from Hawaii, not significantly anyway. It might be that for political reasons, commercial war reasons or whatever, pricing structures will change to reflect that kind of thing. But there's more a question of commercial or economic drive than engineering drive. If you want to know why the pricing structure of internet in the future either stays the same or changes, have a look at the political economic pages of your newspaper rather than some engineering section to figure out what's going on.
Do you think the internet will stay as free as it is today? For instance, in Singapore already the government decides to put proxy servers, and the same applies to China. Does this mean the end of the internet as a sort of an anarchy instrument?
Selectively, I think. At the moment, if I wanted to do something like that in this country, technically, of course, I could. But the users would be the first to complain, I think, not because they were being censored, but because their traffic would be slowed down. It takes time and computing resources to make that kind of sensible censorship possible. And that's the biggest source of complaint. On the other hand, there are fancy ways to censor, that is to say, to look at contents of messages and automatically compute very quickly whether you ought to censor that one or not, which is bad news for the listeners, unfortunately. But I think the time of anarchy is past now. I don't believe that there'll be gross censorship in large areas of the world where the internet operates, but you and I could all make our short lists of countries that would want to apply that kind of thing, and I suspect our list would all be the same. I suspect this is going to go on. And also it's interesting that for the countries which are most likely to do that, so are the customers least likely to shout loudly about delays in their service. Those two are connected.
Don't worry if you miss something today, as you'll hear it later from some other station.
But will you hear and see everything on other stations? From internet, we move now to satellite reception, but we stay with the topic of gatekeepers.
In Malaysia, the initial launch of the Malaysia East Asia satellite, better known as MIASAT, is apparently going well. In 1992, the Malaysian government issued a ban on private satellite dishes. Now the law is to be altered so that individuals will be able to put up a 60-centimeter dish to pick up the digital broadcast from MIASAT. Since the Philips integrated receiver and decoder are designed to only work with MIASAT, the authorities are confident that they maintain a control on what's watched. The MIASAT system carries 22 channels of local and foreign programming, and already some 7,000 decoders have been sold within weeks of the launch. Although the company behind the new system is private, the Malaysian government has a 15% share in the satellite company.
Many industry observers predict that the target of 1 million viewers by the year 2000 will be reached easily, basically because the system offers much better reception and choice than the current terrestrial television system in Malaysia. The government has made a heavy investment in monitoring the content, though. Around 100 staff have been hired to watch the output round the clock and make sure the tight control on the media is maintained. How about that, to be paid to watch television? And that's all we can squeeze into this edition of the programme. On behalf of Diana and myself, have a pleasant weekend.
Some stations talk to the world. Radio Netherlands talks to people.
And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website.
This is Media Network with Jonathan Marks,
where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network programme. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.
I regret to inform you this recording is now officially over.